Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, note 4, text number 12, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Kangshanta karmanam siddhim yajanta iha devataha kshiprahi manushe lohe siddhya bhavati karmaja. Translation. Men in this world desire success in fruitive activities, and therefore they worship the demigods. Quickly, of course, men get results from fruitive work in this world. Purport. There is a great misconception about the gods or demigods of the material world, and men of less intelligence, although passing as great scholars, take these demigods to be various forms of the Supreme Lord. Actually, the demigods are not different forms of God, but they are God's different parts and parcels. God is one and the parts and parcels are many. The Vedas say, Nityo Nityanam, God is one, Ishvarah Paramah Krishnah. The Supreme God is one, Krishna, and the demigods are delegated with powers to manage this material world. These demigods are all living entities, Nityanam, with different grades of material power. They cannot be equal to the Supreme God, Narayan, Vishnu or Krishna. Anyone who thinks that God and the demigods are on the same level is called an atheist or Pashandi. Even the great demigods like Brahma and Shiva cannot be compared to the Supreme Lord. In fact, the Lord is worshipped by demigods such as Brahma and Shiva, Shiva Varinchi Nutam. Yet curiously enough, there are many human leaders who are worshipped by foolish men under the misunderstanding of anthropomorphism or zoomorphism. Iha Devataha denotes a powerful man or demigod of this material world. But Narayana, Vishnu or Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, does not belong to this world. He is above or transcendental to material creation. Even Sripad Shankaracharya, the leader of the impersonalists, maintains that Narayana or Krishna is beyond this material creation. However, foolish people, Hrita Jnana, worship the demigods because they want immediate results. They get the results, but they do not know that results so obtained are temporary and are meant for less intelligent persons. The intelligent person is in Krishna consciousness, and he has no need to worship the paltry demigods for some immediate temporary benefit. The demigods of this material world, as well as their worshippers, will vanish with the annihilation of this material world. The boons of the demigods are material and temporary. Both the material worlds and their inhabitants, including the demigods and their worshippers, are bubbles in the cosmic ocean. In this world, however, human society is mad after temporary things such as material opulence of possessing land, family, and enjoyable paraphernalia. To achieve such temporary things, people worship the demigods or powerful men in human society. If a man gets some ministership in the government by worshipping a political leader, he considers that he has achieved a great boon. All of them are therefore kowtowing to the so-called leaders or big guns in order to achieve temporary boons, and they indeed achieve such things. Such foolish men are not interested in Krishna consciousness for the permanent solution to the hardships of material existence. They are all after sense enjoyment, and to get a little facility for sense enjoyment, they are attracted to worship empowered living entities known as demigods. This verse indicates that people are rarely interested in Krishna consciousness. They are mostly interested in material enjoyment, and therefore they worship some powerful living entity. Kangshanta karmanam siddhim yajanta iha devataha kshiprahi manushe loke siddhya bhavati karmaja. Men in this world desire success in fruitive activities, and therefore they worship the demigods. Quickly, of course, men get results from fruitive work in this world. You probably noticed sometime as you were whizzing in and out of IIT Chennai on your motorbikes, the slogan written, Siddhya Bhavati Karmaja. And you might even have wondered what that meant. Well, here's the answer, in case you didn't know. It's taken from Bhagavad Gita. This verse, I'll read it again, the last line. Kangshanta karmanam siddhim yajanta iha devataha kshipram hi manushe loke siddhya bhavati karmaja. It literally means that perfection is born of work. Or results, you could say results come from work. Which is the motto of materialistic people and is suitable for IIT, because the idea is that you come here, you work, and then you go on and work and you get some result for yourself. You get some money, whatever wages you can earn, and in this way we develop society by making more and more material or technological objects for the supposed improvement of society. So it's interesting that this siddhya bhavati karma ja, perfection comes about by, or results come from work, was adopted. When was IIT founded? Just maybe shortly after its so-called independence? 59, quite some time. It was going on before that under a different name? It was formed by the central government, was it? 51. Whereabouts? Kharagpur was the first one. It's been eclipsed by all the other ones now. So, it's interesting that a Gita shloka was given, or a quote from Bhagavad Gita was given, because in India generally the tendency is still today, or traditionally, has been to put some religious imprint or on everything, or try to connect everything with religion. And modern science traditionally has been at odds with religion. In the Western world, where modern science grew up, it grew up, if we go through history going back to Copernicus, it grew up as a practically as a protest or an alternative worldview to that of the Christian worldview, which was based on the idea that we have to understand everything from the Bible and the church's interpretation of the Bible. But when Copernicus thought that, well, the priests have got it wrong, the sun is not going around the earth is going around the sun, then he got banned. And Galileo, he was lucky to escape with his life for proving it, or supposedly proving it. Although by relativity theory, it could just as well be said the other way around also. And according to Vedic Shastra also, relativity theory could help, because according to Vedic astronomy, the sun is going around not only the earth but all the planets. And you may say, well, we don't believe that, but you can also consider that in India astrology is an ancient science. Of course they don't like to call it a science, but the fact that it's still going on in the modern age suggests that its predictive abilities are not just some kind of imagination. And astrology is based on astronomy. So the ancient Indians, they had knowledge of the universe, and although it may not tally with modern astronomy and cosmology, the fact that they could predict the times of sunrise and the movements of the planets, and it's just like you just had Pongal here, so that's Sankranti. So they can predict they can say what the movements of the planets are. So although there may be some dissimilarities, their astronomy was also very effective. Otherwise, the astrology couldn't have gone on. It's the basis. So there was Vedic science also, and that's still going on to the present day. Anyway, we were talking about how in the Western world, science grew up as a different approach to that of religion. In religion, they just said, believe in the Bible and shut up. And the scientific outlook was, let's look through our telescopes and microscopes and whatever scopes we can scope out, and interpret our results, and then everything, mathematics was developed more and more, although of course there is Vedic mathematics also, still more effective than computers in some usages. It takes more time to enter things in the computer than to do your, at least, algebra with Vedic mathematics. I don't know how it works, but you know that? You can give Vedic mathematician two 17-digit numbers and ask him to multiply, and he'll before you can enter it in the or in your calculator, he'll give you the answer. I don't know how it works, but it does. So, they had their advanced mathematics also. Again, you can't have astronomy without mathematics. So, it was developed. Science was developed in the Western world as the process of human discovery and exploration, which also coincided with Western man's wanting to discover the planet, and then they discovered America, although there are already people living there, although they'd consider it discovery because there was Westerners, and the people who were there previously, they considered them savages. And they discovered India, although there are people living here already. And this way, and especially with the evolutionary theory, really gave the church a hard time. Because if life comes into being by chance, and there's no philosophical need for God, and then there are theories of the universe coming into being by chance, and then you really don't need any God, if everything's just chance. Of course, chance isn't really an explanation. If you say chance, that means you don't know what happened. If there's an explosion, a series of explosions in Coimbatore, and the police, they can't solve it, so they said, well, it all just happened by chance. You could say, then they don't have to bother making any more inquiries and just say, well, we have plenty of evidence that it happened by chance, but it's not really evidence. If you can give evidence, then it's not chance, because evidence shows causation. So to say that everything came into being by chance is just a cop-out, actually. And that the universe has such what they call, there's this, maybe you must be aware, this intelligent design theory is becoming prominent in the Western world among orthodox scientists. Orthodox scientists means university professors and their ilk. So they come out with okay, who can say what is the speed of light? Anyone can say to a few digits. Can you say it to a few more digits? It's not, that's an approximation. Can anyone say it's a lot more digits than that? The point is that if you find all the laws of the universe, they're long digit numbers, 3. Oh, that's pi, okay. But the thing, and it's 10 to the minus, or 10 for 8. No, not minus. So it's a huge figure, but it's solved to so many different digits. Now, if you say like the eighth digit after the decimal point, if it was different, which means a tiny difference, and then the whole universe would be completely different. There are so many constants in the universe, which they've been discovered to so many different decimal points, and if it was like 1 billionth difference, then the whole universe would be completely different. And then how can it be by chance? That is the question which many scientists are asking. If there are so many, I can't, as you've probably discovered by now, I'm not a scientist. But there are so many. Tell me some of the universal constants. You should be able to tell me. Planck's constant. Divine? Wait a minute. You're not supposed to say that. You're a scientist.
By name five. that is many ratios, that is, you know.
Many are coming under that. And then the role of pi. It's almost, it seems almost mystical, doesn't it? What about the periodic table? How everything, or what about the just the multiplication tables? There are so many patterns in there. How is it all, is just by chance? It seems more realistic to think that someone put it all together by design, isn't it? Here's one example I often give. Where's my dabba? Here, give this. Look at this. This came into being by chance. You're not convinced. It just one day there was a big storm, and I found it outside. Just came into being by chance. Someone threw a bomb, and then it all came into. You're all laughing. Why are you laughing? The whole universe came into being by chance. Is it possible for any scientist to calculate how more complex the whole universe is than this? You're going to have to write 10 to the power of, and then stretch the number all the way from here to Bombay. It's unlimitedly more complex. Even one cell is practically unlimitedly more complex than this. But if we say this came to being by chance, it's not even imaginable. Then how can we imagine that the whole universe came into chance? It's ridiculous. And I can confidently say that, and without having a PhD. You don't need a PhD to understand that the universe does not come into being by chance. It is not maintained by chance. So this intelligent design theory is coming up, although it's funny that you need to have a big scientist to tell you that everything is intelligently designed, because even a young child should be able to understand it. But the so-called scientific smokescreen has come up because they found that many of the things the church in the Western world, they found that many of the things the church said don't seem to make, it doesn't correspond with pratyaksha, which means empiric observation. So science is based on empiric observation, but the limits of empiric observation were found practically, it's more than a century now, between relativity and quantum theory, and empiric observation doesn't work anymore, and everything doesn't make sense. As long as Newtonian theory was there, everything seemed to make sense. But as soon as you bring in quantum theory, then it's... No one can understand it. I mean, they can explain it to some extent, but the theories which come out of it, and they don't correspond with reality as it is observed in our daily life. So, what are we talking about? How science came into conflict, and it became a conflicting worldview with that of religion. But it seems that the science of the future is not going to be in conflict with religion, because they've realized more and more, like I'm saying, that orthodox scientists, they've realized that what are the limits of science, which are actually stated in Vedic Shastra, that Brahm Pramad Vipralipsa Karana Partav. These are the four defects by which pratyaksha and anuman, or observation and hypothesis in Western terms, they are valid means of understanding, but they have their limits. And the limits, some of the limiting parameters are our tendencies to make mistakes, our tendency to be illusioned about everything, so that everything we see, we misinterpret everything. Just like if you have a wrong scientific theory, it happens all the, you have a wrong theory and you're trying to, whatever you see, you interpret it according to that theory, but it's all wrong because your theory is wrong. So, or we make mistakes. We have the cheating tendency, which is very prominent in science. It's supposed to be that one neutrally observes and then gives some theory, but people want that they have their pet theories, so sometimes they fudge the research figures. And not only their pet theories, but they're getting funded for their research. So if it's found out that the research project that they're doing, they've discovered that it doesn't work, it's not going nowhere, but they want to keep their research contract going on for another 2-3 years, so they pretend that it's going on nicely. So this is going on, and Brahmapramad and imperfect senses. We presume that by our observation we shall only believe what we can see. That's putting it simply. But then what we see, our senses are imperfect. They have limited ability to see. And what we see, we may misinterpret also. So these are the limits of the empiric method. And scientists more and more are realizing this. And they're realizing more and more that if we are actually to be scientists in the true sense of the term, that means neutral observers of the world and trying to explain how it's going on, then there are many, many things which traditional science simply has written off as unscientific, but phenomena which nevertheless keep on surfacing in human society. An example is theism itself. We in the communist regime, which was in place in Russia, the Soviet world, we can say it was firmly in place for about 60 to 70 years, in which they controlled the education system and the media and everything, and they were against theism. Atheism was practically the state religion or the state dogma. So theism was not encouraged, and they in education they taught in such a manner that people should have become atheists. So if atheism is actually scientific and logical, and religion is the opiate of the people, and religion was simply taught so as to misguide and mislead people, as Karl Marx hypothesized. And actually it's a fact, religion can be and is used to mislead and misguide people. That's true. But if it's a fact that religion is only some imagination for less intelligent people, then having removed the religious education and the whole structure of religion in the Soviet state, and actively taught atheism through the school system, through the media system, then it should have been that definitely within 2 or 3 generations, if people are rational and they're no longer cheated by these ideas of God, then everyone should have been a pukka atheist. But we find that as soon as the Soviet regime collapsed, immediately people came out and they're highly theistic. People in Russia are more theistic. More people believe in God than in Western Europe. Our Hare Krishna movement is very widely spread there, actually. So this suggests that either human beings in general are highly irrational, and there's plenty of other evidence for that, but it also suggests that religion or belief in God is an inherent part of human nature. That's just one example. There are so many phenomena which are not explained or explainable by traditional science. For instance, and we don't like to talk about this much, especially at night, but all over the world, in all cultures, up to the present day, there are so many stories of ghosts. And even there was a best-selling book in the 1970s. There was I think it was the 70s or 80s, a plane flying from USA, somewhere in Florida to somewhere in South America, crashed. And then what happened on that same flight means, it's a, you know, just like it's a regular flight. Say it was Miami to Caracas or something like this. So when the when they were flying on that route and the same airline, then from time to time someone would come on the PA system and announce, and then the captain would say, "Who's that?" And then sometimes they saw, the stewardess would see someone sitting in the uniform of the airline and say, "Oh, I didn't know you were on this flight." And then she'd go back and he wasn't there anymore. There it means that the ghost of the captain of the flight kept on coming on the flight, and they had to, and then none of their staff wanted to fly that route anymore. They had to cancel the service. There's a book written about it. So that's just an example of how these phenomena continue to exist despite the fact that orthodox science doesn't recognize it. And so what's happening nowadays, one of the many developments in science, is that orthodox scientists are beginning to look at this and say, "Hey, look, this is some phenomena," when it's something that's not going away. It's something which is there in human experience, and we can't explain it by orthodox science, so there must be some levels of reality which we are not able to access by our present methods. So they have to start looking at different methods or a different view of reality. So in future we can expect that religion and science, they can come together, which actually there was never any need for them breaking up. In Vedic culture, there's no division between science and religion. In fact, what is called religion, there's no real word for that in Vedic culture, because it's just life. It's just everything. What is called religion, it's not some compartment of human life or experience, but the whole of the whole human existence is lived in accord with dharma, you can say, which means living. Dharma means understanding the subtle laws of the universe and acting according to them. Now, there are the laws of karma. If we accept that every action has an equal and opposite reaction, then karma is quite acceptable, because action is not only on the gross level, it affects on the experiential level also. You can say that you can cut the throat of the animal and eat the meat and you get this much protein, but there's apart from that, there's also the experience of pain and fear that the animal feels at the time of being killed. So that's also an action which gives rise to a reaction. So all these things are already discussed in the Vedic literature, and we can expect that in future more and more the orthodox science, of course it hasn't come to that stage yet, but it seems that gradually that the old paradigm of scientists being rigidly atheistic is going to have to change, and it's coming about. Now, this intelligent design theory is mostly floated by Christians in the Western world, although some of them who are floating it, they're not religious per se. They're not floating intelligent design theory because it's not that they're Christians and therefore they say we believe in intelligent design, but they just say that the phenomena as we observe it, they do not support evolutionary theory or theories such as Big Bang theory. It appears that there must be some design. So they've come not from religion, and it's not that they're imposing religion on science, but rather that by science they're coming to the conclusion that there must be some intelligent design, as they say. So actually religion and science should come to the same conclusion. There shouldn't be any dichotomy between them. It's artificial, actually. But the thing is that science in the Western world grew up simply on this basis, this empiric basis, that what we can see and what we can extrapolate from that, without considering that what are the limits of our pratyaksha. How much can we see, and what are the limits of our intelligence to understand? What do we see? We can only see within a certain range of light, and apart from that, there may be so many phenomena that we are totally unable to see, and that's also been there are various theories of antimatter or invisible matter within the universe. So there may be, it's postulated that there may be parallel universes which were of a different kind of matter that are existing right here and right now all around us that we have no experience of, because our senses our senses are attuned to a certain kind of matter, which there may be other kinds of matter also which they're not attuned to. So there are so many possibilities of what could be going on that we have no access to. Apart from that, we should be able to admit that our senses are extremely limited. And our ability to understand what we observe is also, it's limited by the worldview that we have imbibed. And the worldview that we have imbibed is based on our position as a tiny little creature on a tiny little planet in a tiny little galaxy somewhere, and some tiny blip in time. We're tiny blobs in space and tiny blips in time. So how much can we understand? So Vedic science, it gives much information on all different kinds of subjects. One guru bhai of mine, Guru Bhrata, who's an astrologer, he's American, and he advises many people from what we could call orthodox or secular American society. And one of his clients is a gynecologist, so he sent a description of the development of the embryo in the womb according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, and said this is coming from scripture 5,000 years ago. And said, how do they know that? We only discovered this in the last century. According to the Vedic knowledge, this knowledge, how do we know? Because it's given by the person who set it up in the first place. He should know what's going on. It's a God's eye view of the universe. So Vedic science is based not so much on experimentation as on simply taking the knowledge which is given there. And actually most science in the world is going on like that. It's not, there are some research scientists, but even the research scientists, what they research, first of all, they have to just accept knowledge as given from others. If we all had to start off now with just by our own endeavors, none of us would get as far as Newton, isn't it? So we accept knowledge as given by others. So the Vedic system is to accept the knowledge given in Shastra with the a priori or acceptance that there is an intelligent designer, and he has set up the universe, and he's given us knowledge of it, how we can live here for the sake of getting out of it. Because this world is not all in all anyway. And whether you accept the Vedic knowledge or whether you go by modern or ancient, any kind of atheism, anyway, everything here is very temporary. If we say, according to most popular modern theories, that the universe is expanding and at some point in time, there won't be any universe. Or even if we say that life is simply a product of matter, then anyway the universe is going to be finished, and well before that, this body that we're living in, that we identify as me, that's going to be finished. So why bother studying so many things anyway? Because what's the point? If everything's just finished, then why should we bother? We just, you know, lie down on a hammock somewhere and enjoy the breeze. Why work so hard? But actually the Vedic information that tells us that yes, the universe is temporary, yes, the body is temporary, but yes, also, the soul is eternal. And that endeavor to, or that urge to want to know, why should that be? Why should we be so much concerned to know so many different things? Why, the cow is there, it gives some milk, you take some milk, and the tree gives some fruit, and eat some fruit, and just be happy. And why do we have to see how the cow is eating the grass and how the grass turns into milk? We still didn't make any artificial cows. You put grass in and milk comes out the other side. Anyone want to invent it? Could make a lot of money, but I doubt you're going to be able to. So we can study, or we can study how the grass grows, chlorophyll and light and all this kind of thing. Why should we study? Why aren't you content? Just feed the cow some grass and take the milk. Why do you have to study chlorophyll and then breeding different cows and different kinds of grass and genetically altered grass and all different kinds of things? Why this urge to study? Why the urge to live at all? If this body is just some machine, in essence not much difference to a truck, then why should we be so concerned to live? The truck doesn't... If you crash the truck owner gets upset, but the truck doesn't get upset. It's just... because it's just matter. So if this body is just matter, then why should we be bothered? Someone dies. Or there's some murder case. So someone crashed a truck and he's fined for bad driving. And the next person comes in, murder case, okay, 10 years in prison. Now why? It's just the same thing. Someone smashed up a truck and I smashed up a body. So just give me a fine and let me go. It's the same thing. It's just a machine, that's all. Why? Why the urge to know? Why the urge to live? The Vedic information tells us because we are more than the body. The body is temporary, but we are eternal soul. And the urge to know, that is one of the impulses of the soul, because the soul by nature is Satchidananda, eternal. Why do we want to live? Because it is our nature as Atma to be eternal. Why do we want to know? Because it is our nature as Atma to be knowledgeable. Why do we want to be happy? Because it's the nature of the soul to be happy. So there's no answer for that. And you can go to psychology and try to study why we want to be happy, or why should it be that we feel now it's a very nice climate, and when it's in the middle of May, in midday, if we were to sit here in the same place, we would feel uncomfortable due to the... But if it, you don't find a truck feels uncomfortable. Why? Why do we feel this climate is quite pleasant? And even in this winter, in the midday, it's too hot, isn't it, to sit outside in the sun? So-called winter of Tamil Nadu. So why do we perceive something as pleasant and something as unpleasant? What is the nature of consciousness? This is one of the questions which is altering science, which came up in quantum theory, so I'm told. That it was understood that one of the factors, one of the indispensable factors is the observer himself and how he interprets. Then that comes to what is the nature of consciousness. So consciousness studies. That's actually, it's amazing, it took so many hundreds of years for science to study what is the nature of consciousness. even psychology, they didn't attempt to understand this, or they tried to equate consciousness as simply a neurological function, but it's not. They've discovered people with literally no brain who are genii. There's no gray matter. It's not that everyone's like that, but there are people who they don't have brains, but they're brilliant. Or there are so many instances we find someone, for instance, they have a heart attack and then they're in hospital and they're looking down at the body. This is something else which they're looking down at their body. They're under anesthesia and they're able to describe afterwards the whole operation which took place with all its details. Even what the surgeon was saying, even though they have no knowledge of surgery, because they were out of the body, the brain was not working, but the subtle body, in the astral body, they look. So there are so many points which scientists, they're taking note of, that actually the orthodox science, which has rigidly denied religion over all these years, has... It can't answer many of the important points that we need to assess. You can't go on denying forever that there is consciousness, that there are so many levels of reality which we can simply say, well, we deny it. It's like closing your eyes and saying, there's no trees. but everyone else is saying there's trees. Well, I can't see it, so there's no trees. But then you become less, in the name of being a jnani or a scientist, you're actually limiting your knowledge. And if you don't attempt to explain it scientifically, then someone will attempt to explain it in, we could say, a kind of quackish way. So, but then again, science, science as it has been traditionally known, it has been limited to this empiric method. But that's what I'm saying, the whole vista of science has to open up to allow methods of knowledge gathering which are beyond that of just very gross empiricism. And actually that's there within the human experience. A human being is not simply an empiric or logical animal like Dr. Spock in Star Trek, who's supposed to be just logical. But it's human beings have feelings, not only human beings, animals also, they have feelings and emotions. And this, we cannot deny that this is part of the human experience. When we talk of art, we see something, this art, this painting, or this music, or this sculpture, we perceive it as being beautiful. Why? Why do we perceive this young woman looks very beautiful and this one doesn't? What is that perception? That is, even that is beyond the that of raw empiricism. So empiricism has a very limited scope. And actually, as human beings, we don't rely on empiricism. In our day-to-day life, empiricism is it's only a very small part of our thinking process. If you only, just like if you only think what food is good for me to eat, then you'd probably have a very boring diet. To some extent, it should do, but there's also taste, matter of taste. So, science has been extremely limited and can open up more. But even then, science, will always have its limitations, because the human intelligence has its limitations. But human intelligence can be given a quantum boost by accepting knowledge from the Supreme Intelligent. Just like all of you are more advanced in knowledge than Newton, although you're not as great scientists as Newton, but you're more advanced in knowledge because you've been able to take knowledge from other scientists who have built on the knowledge that Newton gave. So if we can get knowledge from the top, then our knowledge will be greater than anyone who's trying to get it simply by his own mental speculation. That's why I can confidently say that I'm a better scientist than Einstein. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But scientist means you should be able to tell what's going on. You should know what's happening. So in terms of theoretical knowledge, of course, I'm not even a speck of dust compared to Einstein. But in terms of the conclusion of how the universe is working, I can confidently say I know better because I'm taking knowledge from the one who set it up in the first place. As Einstein said, after studying all these years the nature of the universe, I just wonder, my only question is how God created it all. Well, I can tell you. I can tell Einstein too, but he's not here these days. He didn't get that. Who knows where he is? Krishna knows where he is. So this is a method of taking knowledge which has come down in Vedic epistemology. It's recommended that although pratyaksha and anuman, which is observation and hypothesis, they have their place, but they are not as authoritative as shabda or Veda Praman. So if we take knowledge from the Vedas, then we can automatically get the complete picture as far as we, being tiny limited beings, can perceive. So we are hopeful that the unnecessary competition or dissipariousness between science and religion may be resolved. This intelligent design theory is coming up in the Western countries very strongly now, and that means more or less accepting God. But then if we accept God, then you come back to the same problems that starting with Copernicus, that the Christian dogma, it doesn't really give any information about how God created the universe or how the universe is running on. But the Vedic knowledge does. So we're very hopeful that the Vedic knowledge, when people start to say, okay, all right, there's God, so how are we to understand who is God and how he's running on the universe? We're very hopeful that if people are actually intelligent and philosophically open-minded, that they can come to the Vedic knowledge and get that information. So you can be more than technologists if you take up this Vedic science. There's a lot of work to do in research also, because the Vedic science, although it works in its own way, but it's a different paradigm to that of modern science. Just like relativity theory works in its own way and quantum theory works in its own way, but it's difficult to put them together. But you can't deny because they work. So the Vedic knowledge also, in many ways, it doesn't seem to fit with modern science. But then, like you say, in so many fields, in gynecology and astronomy, it works. So there's a lot of work to do to show, to demonstrate to modern scientists how the Vedic knowledge is practical and how it works. And it's quite possible that in futures, of course that's already been going on to some extent since the middle of the 20th century, that Western scientists will start looking to the Vedic knowledge for clues as to how to go forward in their understanding of the universe at so many different levels. there is tremendous amount of scientific knowledge, but as with much of the Vedic knowledge, it's been lost, or it's lost, or it's not understood, or it's not very widely spread. So there is a lot of work for reviving Vedic science. So maybe your future careers will be more exciting than you can imagine. Definitely there are big changes ahead in the whole world outlook. There are so many things to be said. It's for instance, there was a dream at one time that by science and technology would make a better world, but now in the Western countries many people are feeling that it would be better if we went back to bullock carts. There's so many problems in modern technological society, and it's so dangerous that anyone anywhere can just become a 15-year-old boy a few years ago was arrested. He made plans for constructing an atomic bomb. He just got the knowledge from, that was before the days of the internet. He just got the knowledge. He said, where do you get this knowledge from? Just from the local library. That's all. So, of course, he didn't have the materials to do so, but he was making plans. And he must have been a pretty brilliant kid, but the point is that it's a very dangerous world we live in, and it's not controllable. So, it's very widespread in the Western world that people they've lost faith in the whole idea of making a better world by science, and they're thinking if we could go back to a more simple way of life. And also there's a lot of increasing faith in ancient traditional knowledge. I recently met a devotee from Australia, and he said that 4 out of 5 people in Australia, if they consult a physician, they go to a naturopath or a Vaidya, Ayurvedic doctor, or some, rather than going to the allopathic doctor. The people they presume that that natural systems of healing or traditional systems will be better for them and more effective. So this says a lot about the direction that human society is going in. We can expect more and more changes. Even from the sociological point of view, the American sociologists, there are several books well known among sociologists in the West who say that Western civilization is finished already. It's in its last throes. It looks very strong still, but it's all the signs of a dead civilization. It's a decadent civilization. It can't stand. A society that allows homosexual marriages, for instance, such decadence, it's just one example. Such decadence is the sign of the end of a civilization. America's now dominating Iraq by technology, and most of their technologists are imported from Asia anyway. So, but if it was a man-to-man fight, then if they had the same weapons and they had to fight against the Arabs, they'd have no hope. They don't have the determination. So that determination by which civilizations are built up, that's gone. Now it's a decadent society. America's just, people are, they don't have the will to work hard. They just want to enjoy their senses in so many different degraded ways. And the Western countries are still going on, but it's mostly that, just like you'll find, there are so many IITians and software engineers going out from India to America. Why the Americans, they can't supply from their own? Because the American kids, they don't have that idea to work hard, and they just want to enjoy life. And that means their society is actually, Western civilization is, and the ideals that it was based on, it's a failure. And it's probably not more than 50 years. This whole outlook on life that's coming from the Western world, that's not going to be prominent in human society, although it's difficult to say what will be. Some people are predicting that Islam will become very prominent. I'm hoping that by the grace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement, the Krishna conscious solution to the problems of human society can come about. But that will require, on all levels of human society, the presenting the Vedic viewpoint in a practical way. And that, of course, science is the predominant vector in human thought at the present time. So definitely it's required that that Vedic science, Vedic science can give the solutions to so many problems within science and within the application of science. There are two things. There are scientific problems themselves, and then there are problems in the application of that, how that's applied in human society. So the Vedic outlook has science itself, and it also has the balance, how science is integrated into human life and the human experience, with the understanding that human life is ultimately meant for God realization. And that whatever we do in this world and whatever we develop in this world, that is there so that we can live in this world in as undisturbed a manner as is possible in this world which is disturbed by nature. But living relatively comfortably, or for which purpose? Not simply for the sake of living comfortably, but for developing God realization. So it's an integrated approach, understanding what is dharma. Everything is meant for dharma. Idam hi pungsas tapasas shutasya va svishtasya suktasya cha buddhidata yoho avichutartha kavibhya nirupita yad uttama shloka gunarna varnanam. Srimad Bhagavatam states that all endeavors of human society, cultivation of knowledge, philosophy, art, religion, all of this should culminate in understanding and glorifying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's within a proper perspective that science is there and it has its place in human society, but the attempt to make this world a better place to live so that we can enjoy ourselves here, that is a misguided attempt, because we don't belong here and we have a bigger destination. We have a bigger... The glory of the human race is not simply in building big buildings and making space rockets to go, even if you go to, you know, however far you can imagine to go, it's just like going to the next bus stop in terms of space. So we can't go very far anyway. So the glory of human society will not be going to Jupiter or whatever, but the glory will be going beyond this, beyond the coverings of the universe, by the spiritual method of travel, which is the only method by which we can go beyond this. Bhumirapo nalo vayu kangmano buddhireva cha ahankara ityang me bhina prakriti rashtada. In this verse of Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna, he states what are the components of the material world: earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. But to go beyond that, we have to come apare amitas tvam yang prakritim vidhime param jiva bhutang mahabaho. What's the last line? Yedam dharyate jagat. That beyond this matter, there is the soul. We are soul. So we can transcend matter. That is the real goal of human life. To transcend matter and go beyond the material universe, through the coverings of the universe, to the spiritual world. So this is the actual perfection to be achieved by work. If we say, I got off the topic here, Siddhi Bhavati Karmaja, we can achieve perfection by work, but then we should realize that the highest work is not simply working to make this body comfortable, but working so that we don't get any more bodies which are by nature uncomfortable. So that is the highest work. This They incorporated this with the idea, this idea in modern science that we shall make the world better by our own endeavors. This is not actually the sense at all in which this is used in Bhagavad Gita. But it's been, they took it and they recast it in the modern empiric scientific paradigm. But this is actually concerned with the karma kanda of the Vedas, and it's specifically concerned with demigod worship. That's yajante iha devataha. So they took it out of context. So actually Krishna is saying here, what he's saying is that people, they follow the karma kanda. That means people understand that within this universe, that for every action there is a reaction. So they try to do punya karma, by which they get a good reaction. And by worshipping the devas, they bless you. So you can get kshiprang hi manushe loke, but you can quickly get a result. But then, later on in Gita, Krishna goes on to explain, antavattu palangte shang tad bhavatyalpamedhasam, that whatever material result you can get by worshipping the demigods is only temporary. Therefore, people who are interested in material results, they are foolish. So whether your karma is by karma kanda of the Vedas, or whether it's by the ugra karma of developing modern technology, the result is temporary. So an intelligent person should not endeavor for that which is temporary, but he should endeavor for that which is of eternal benefit. And that is as true today as when Lord Krishna spoke that 5,000 years ago. So understanding that we are eternal living beings, if we accept this as a hypothesis, because you can't prove it scientifically, then that should alter our whole outlook on life. Now we say, well, if you can't prove it scientifically, well, why should we accept it? But if we say scientifically, science is concerned with matter, and spirit is not matter, therefore you can't measure it by any material means. That is the very definition of spirit. So science, by materialistic science, by denying, but we can't measure it, therefore we don't accept that it exists. It denies the whole spiritual experience. It just cuts itself off and very proudly says that, well, we don't need it. But we do need it. People are not... It's an inherent human need. That example of the Soviet system. There's an inherent human craving for spiritual understanding. It's you may say, well, why is that there? That's modern Freud said that religion is a crutch. It's a psychological crutch. That was his theory. But another way of looking at it is, well, if there's a need, that suggests that there is, that it is an inherent facet of our being. Just like if you're feeling thirsty, why? Because there's a need for water, and there is such a thing as water, and when we drink it, we feel satisfied. So if we have if there is an inherent human tendency to want to understand God or to understand spiritual life, that suggests that there is such a thing as a spiritual experience, and that over the centuries and up to the present day, people have spiritual experiences, suggests that there, it is real. And even though there's nothing you can strap to the arm, or you can't put something on the brain and measure spiritual experiences, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just that there's a different way to, there's different methodology for understanding it. Even within science, you see when you, in the kids at school, they, in the physics lab, you have your prisms, and in the biology lab, you have scalpels, and in the chemistry lab, you have Bunsen burners. Bunsen burners aren't much use in the biology lab. There's a different methodology. If you want to study the history of Chennai, Bunsen burner won't help you much. It doesn't mean that history is an invalid subject because you don't use Bunsen burners, but there's a different methodology. So in studying spiritual life, there's mapiyate anaya iti maya. Maya means to measure. And empiric science is concerned with measuring. So spiritual life means that which is not Maya. So it's a different methodology. But to say that it's invalid because it's different is childish, actually. So practically, although science has developed over all these years and in many ways has come up with many wonderful things, its outlook has been very childish, that there's no God, I can't see. There's no life after death, prove it. It's a childish outlook, that because you can't measure it by your systems, therefore it doesn't exist. It's foolish and proud. So spiritual life begins with becoming humble, and the scientists at last, they're becoming somewhat humble and saying, well, we don't know. We don't. There are so many things we can't explain. Maybe we should try and find out by some other methodology. There was one anthology I read about 10 years ago. It was different scientists talking about how by studying raw science they'd become interested in spirituality. And the compiler of the book, he said that he gave the analogy that over the last several centuries, scientists have been very laboriously and with great difficulty ascending the great mountain of knowledge. And at last, they're just coming to the peak, and they pull themselves up with great difficulty, and they come to the peak of the mountain and find there's a group of theologians who are waiting patiently for them there. So, that's what we're hoping for. Of course, there will always be atheists. Even in the Vedic age, there were atheists. Charvak, famous atheistic philosophy. Rinang gritva gritang pibet. Yavaj jivet sukham jivet. Bhasmi bhutasya dehasya kingpuna agamano bhavet. In very nice Sanskrit, he has said that beg, borrow, or steal, but somehow or other, get ghee and enjoy life. Because as long as you live, you should enjoy, because when the body is finished, it's burned, and then there's no evidence that we come back again. So he was a Vedic atheist. Even then he didn't say to eat meat, he said to eat ghee. So even the Vedic atheist had some little culture. So there will always be atheists, but persons who are... Actually, you'll find that the really big scientists, they all understand that there's something there more than we can understand. All the big scientists, Newton, Einstein, they say this, Stephen Hawking, even he finished out his brief history of time with the word God, the last word in his book. Of course, he's an atheist, but he said, we will understand the mind of God. So he has some concept of God. But the idea that we can understand the mind of God is overly ambitious. But all the really big scientists, those who have some real insight, who are very deep and thoughtful, they can all understand that actually there's something there more than we can understand. And at the lower level, there's no God, there's only science. It's childish, actually. We don't have any argument with real science, but only with people who are childishly enamored by science and thinking that it's all in all and can tell us everything and solve all the problems of human society. We don't, even in religion, we don't think we can know everything. If you think we know everything, then that is it's an overestimate of our ability. Rather, we shall depend on He who knows everything. That is more realistic. We are tiny beings. Hare Krishna. That's all I'm going to say for now, unless any of you have any questions. Sorry I didn't present it more scientifically, but I'm not a scientist. You can ask Bhanu Swami to come. He's very learned in so many different fields of human knowledge. Why, Rasaraj Prabhu comes here sometimes? He comes and speaks here. He's a real scientist. You heard some of Rasaraj Prabhu's lectures? He came, yeah, he's one. He knows his stuff. He's got lots of insights, both sides. So if you can be like him, that would be very good. Very good knowledge of Shastra and very good knowledge of science. I mean, it's vast. Shastric knowledge is vast and scientific knowledge is vast, but he knows how the two things go together. So you're all big South Indian brains given by God, and you can use that in the service of God by showing that real science means to understand Bhagavad Gita as it is. If you can do that, that will be the perfection of your scientific knowledge. Yeah, so you wanted to ask something? Religion is limited? Well, ultimately nothing's limited, is it? Science isn't limited, there's no end. Years ago I saw on TV that two Oxford scientists had spent 5 years studying 1 square mile of forest. And they said, they said at the end of that, then they wrote their PhD thesis. And at the end of that, they said that if you gave us 1,000 scientists for 1,000 years, we couldn't even write 1/1000th of what's to be discovered there. Newton also, he said, after studying so much, I feel as if I'm on a great beach, of the great beach of knowledge, and I've picked up a few grains of sand, that's all. So even matter is unlimited, to what to speak of Bhagavan. But we can understand him to some extent by his mercy. Therefore he gives us Bhagavad Gita. We can understand him to some extent. Aham sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartate. Everything comes from him. Mayadhyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam hetunanena kontaya jagad viparivartate. He says that this whole material cosmos is going on under my direction, and all phenomena, both moving and non-moving, they're working under my direction. So to some extent we can understand it. Vedic knowledge tells us that the engineer or the sub-creator of this universe, that Bhagavan, Vishnu, he gives the ingredients, but the engineer's job is done by Brahma. So Brahma, he speaking about Krishna, says, Jananta eva janantu kingba hukchana me prabhu manaso vapaso vacha vaibhavam tava gochara. He said that others may think I know about Krishna, but as far as I'm concerned, and he's the biggest brain in the universe, four brains, much bigger than Einstein's, or much more effective than Einstein's. And it's not just the brain, it's the thought process. So he says, as far as I'm concerned, neither by mental activities nor by study or by any means can I even think that I begin to know hardly anything about Krishna. We can know Krishna by love. That's the best way to know. And actually, love is more important than knowledge. What's the use if you know so many things but you don't even have any friends? You'll be miserable. That's what's going on in human society at the present time. There's so much emphasis on knowing things and earning money, but people don't have friends. They don't have good relations, and people are going crazy. Because what people need, what the jiva needs, more than knowledge, is love. There's sat, chit, ananda, and among them all, ananda is the most important. And ananda comes from love, and love means exchange, give and take. But modern life is give as little as possible and take as much as you can. Whereas love means give everything and take nothing. So that's missing in human society. With so much emphasis, everyone should be a consumer and grab as much as you can for yourself. But it doesn't lead to happiness, it leads to just the opposite. So by love, Krishna reveals himself to his devotee. It's not possible. The Vedic knowledge is there, that gives some indication. But ultimately, we have to love Krishna, and then he'll reveal himself to us. Even if you learn all the Vedas and become a big pundit, that itself won't give us. Krishna will not reveal himself to us. So, are you going to say something more?
Then if religion is unlimited, science is limited, then how both can be same?
No, science is also unlimited, but it has its limit. We have our limitations. God is unlimited, and we can understand Him to some extent only because we are limited. Science, you can go on studying. You could write hundreds of books about this, about how it was the technology that led to its development, and then all the different materials, and why they're using these materials, and then how the steel is developed, and then the molecular structure. You could write hundreds of books just on the molecular structure. Everything's unlimited. But we should find out that knowledge which is vital to us. Just like I'm saying, you can study how the grass grows and try to make different, better grass and this and that. Or you can just feed the grass to the cow and be happy and take the milk, offer it to Krishna. A lot of the knowledge we're developing, we may say ultimately, you know, what has it really benefited human society? We can go faster from one place to another, but then there's so much pollution and the big cities, the life, people are not happy, they're not even comfortable. So, if you judge in terms of human happiness and morality, the modern society is backward compared to what it was previously. So ultimately, what is the advancement? If it's meant for the betterment of human society, and human society is such nowadays that the father can't trust his son and the son can't trust his father, and he may not even know his father, because in the Western world it's quite common, because it's divorce is just normal. Or even they don't even get married. They don't even bother getting married. Then what's the point? We're going to divorce anyway. So, is it really advancement of human society? We should consider. Religion is required to elevate the human spirit. If we don't elevate, then we must degrade. And that's what's been going on. We've been developing science and technology with the idea of making life more comfortable and getting more and more gadgets. But there's been the elevation of the human spirit has been forgotten. It's been considered not necessary, and we've degraded. It was when the internet was first being developed, the web, they're thinking, "Well, this is wonderful. We can share knowledge so much." But so that's there. But the by far the most dominant use of the internet is for pornography. What's that? It's degraded. So science and scientists need religion. Everyone needs. Without that, the human spirit becomes degraded to sub-animal. Actually, that's what's going on at the present time. Shall we chant Hare Krishna for a few minutes?